Bonus episode of Unboxing God. Last week's full episode began with Jung's concept of personal unconscious, and for today's bonus episode, we're going to unbox that just a little bit more. Okay, let's start with the shadow. The shadow is a representation of our personal unconscious as a whole. It usually embodies the compensating values to the ones that we hold in our conscious personality. So the shadow represents our dark side, basically, the aspects of ourselves that exist but we don't really want to acknowledge, or that we just can't identify with. In Jungian psychology, the shadow, the id, the shadow aspect, it all refers to the entirety of the unconsciousness, everything that we're not fully aware of. It's our unknown side. Because we automatically reject or remain ignorant of all our least desirable aspects, the shadow is thought of as negative. But I'm convinced that especially in people with low self-esteem or anxieties or false-held beliefs, that there's hidden positive aspects within that shadow. I'll get to that more later. According to Jung, the shadow, in being instinctive and irrational, is prone to psychological projection. Psychological projection is when we see some inferiority in ourselves and perceive it as a deficiency in someone else, because we can't handle seeing it in ourselves, but we then see it everywhere else. Jung writes, if these projections remain hidden, the projection-making factor, the shadow, then has a free hand and can realize its object, if it has one, or bring about some other situation characteristic of its power. These projections insulate and harm us by acting as a constantly thickening veil of illusion between our ego and the real world. Jung also made the suggestion of there being more than one layer making up the shadow. It's like the top layers contain the meaningful flow and manifestations of direct personal experiences. These are made unconscious in the individual by such things as change of attention from one thing to another, simple forgetfulness, or maybe even repression. But underneath these idiosyncratic layers, there are archetypes, which form the, quote, psychic contents of all human experience. Jung described this deeper layer as a psychic activity which goes on independently of the conscious mind and is not dependent even on the upper layers of the unconscious, untouched and perhaps untouchable by personal experience. But we're going to unbox that part of the shadow in next week's full episode, number 10, when we unbox archetypes. Also, dreams can show us our shadow that our consciousness won't, and we're going to talk about that next week also. But let's get back to the masks. There's this video of Jordan Peterson, and he's talking about Pinocchio and the false persona. He breaks down the song from Pinocchio, "The Actor's Life for Me," and he remarks of the pull of the idea of being an actor. Get everything, but do and be nothing real. It's kind of the dark side of fake it till you make it. Now, we create our masks by comparing the outsides of others, their masks, to our insides, our full selves, including our shadow selves that we're aware of. Nietzsche's good, bad judgment and suppression of what we feel is bad or unmanageable. By the way, I have an inner mantra, feelings aren't facts, to battle just that. Well, when we assume we're powerless and we push that bad self down, we lock it up, maybe by instinct or maybe with full intention. Perhaps we remain conscious of the fact that it's there, but we've shoved so much inside of us into that closet that now even peeking in, opening the door just slightly, could create a tidal wave of crap that will surely overtake us. So we act like we think we should. And behavior creates character, but it also solidifies the mask self. And it creates a further divide and distance from the shadow, a split, for the sake of comfort. And it does become very uncomfortable. But by that time, we're like Jim Carrey in The Mask, and the mask now dictates our behavior. Everyone carries a shadow, Jung wrote. And the less it is embodied in the individual's conscious life, the blacker and denser it is. The shadow hides some pretty dark stuff. I mean, I suspect we all have thoughts that scare even us. I sure have. Do. My gut reaction is to separate myself entirely from those thoughts, wave them away, not even dare to go there, no less trace them back upstream from whence they might have come. And yet, I am fully convinced that it is precisely upstream from my shadow self where the true integration can happen, the real healing. If I stay where I think I'm most comfortable, then I'm not really ever expanding. If I don't challenge what I think I know about myself, then so much of me is going to remain undiscovered, unrecovered, stagnant and growing mold in the dark recesses that I dare not explore. But what happens when I throw things down in that dark, dank place? They love it. They multiply and spread, and the shadow grows, not the self. It lets us close our eyes to it so that it can become stronger and less suspected, just waiting to rage out and take us by surprise. I say, instead, explore. Imagine. Experiment. We grow in our discomfort and discontent. When I wake up each day, now I put on an imaginary lab coat. It's part of the 12-step recovery program I'm a grateful member of. There's this daily reader called Courage to Change, which is exactly what I'm seeking daily. The serenity, the courage, and the wisdom, right? Well, this reading is for March 26th. That's on page 86, and it's what I call my soul's prescription for progress. When I read it, still, after I've memorized it back and forth, it feels like the Fugees said, strumming my pain with their fingers and singing my life with their words. This is how it starts. Anything worth doing, goes a slightly cockeyed version of the old saying, is worth doing badly. Perfectionism, procrastination, and paralysis are three of the worst effects of alcoholism upon my life. Now, the book says alcoholism, but really, you can fill in that blank. Where is your perfectionism, procrastination, and paralysis from? Can you follow it upstream? As if the deep identification I felt in those first two sentences weren't enough, that same page goes on to say, I have a tendency to spend my life waiting for the past to change. I want to spend the first 100 years of my life getting all the kinks ironed out, and the next 100 years actually living. Such an inclination to avoid taking risks, to avoid doing anything badly, has prevented me from doing some of the things I enjoy the most, and it has kept me from the regular practice that produces progress. If I'm unwilling to perform a task badly, I can't expect to make progress towards learning to do it well. The only task that I can pretend to perform perfectly is the one I have left entirely undone. And if that right there weren't enough, then I get this bit called today's reminder at the end. It says, Al-Anon, which is the program I'm in, encourages me to take risks and to think of life not as a command performance, but as a continuing series of experiments from which I learn more about living. And then at the very bottom, there's this quote by James Russell Lowell. All the beautiful sentiments in the world weigh less than a single lovely action. But it's this sentence. Think of life not as a command performance, but as a continuing series of experiments from which I learn more about living. That was truly the key for me, to do just what it suggested. Experiment. And almost every waking moment of practically every single day of my life used to feel like a command performance. I mean, my mask was perpetually attached by what I felt was necessity at points. It was like armor to protect me, especially as a child. But for the most part, I really didn't question it. I just thought, I guess that's who I am. Or worse, I would place blame. That's who she made me into. They created. This required. Perpetually the victim, and most often the martyr as well. So many roles I played, uncomfortably, but in the mask. And at some point I realized that not only were the roles playing me, I hadn't ever even escaped the shadow. Yet how does one somehow emerge from out of the part that they've formed such attachment to? The role they keep repeating over and over with the same lines, the same unmanageable reactions. For me, it's about experimentation, a continuing series of experiments from which I learn more about living. And here's why I think it works for me. If I mentally put on my lab coat in the morning to do experiments, well, it just naturally follows that I establish a hypothesis for the day, right? I try to make sure it's something simple and measurable, an isolated variable that I can test. I mean, y'all had to do a science project in fifth grade, so I trust you're with me. Some past and present experiments of mine include not using ought or should or must or need to, not to myself or to others. Kyle and the kids catch me messing up much less since I started this challenge at the beginning of the year. Another one is, what if just for today, I don't rush at all, for any reason? What if I don't yell? What if I give everyone I speak to today a heartfelt compliment? What if I don't worry for more than 5 minutes about anything that won't matter in 5 years? What if I don't future trip for this entire day, and I stay totally in the present moment? And it's one experiment a day, and it's always just for today, a well-known and widely used 12-step tool, much like the Serenity Prayer, which always helps reset my day's experiment when things start to, you know, go sideways. So, with my mental lab coat on, throughout my day as a good scientist, I can't futz with the experiment. I've got to change the one variable and be consistent and as vigilant as I'm able to. And then hands off. It's observation time. If I'm able, I find clever ways to do check-ins to remind myself about the proper procedure. Labs have safety signs everywhere, right? Well, I've used a rotating desktop to remind me, a knockoff Fitbit that was set to vibrate every hour. For a while, it was the tiny yellow post-it notes that my husband put all around our home with these little words of gratitude for things that made him think of me. Each time I'd see a post-it note, I'd allow it to pull me back into that lab coat mode. So yeah, all day, I try to gather data and test my hypothesis. Even when it feels like the whole lab may burn down and my dis-ease tells me that I'm ruining everything and there's surely going to be a cost. May burn? Going to be a cost? That is future tripping, and worrying won't change it anyway. Gotta stay present to get data, and it works. It's kind of crazy some of the awareness I've gained about myself and the world and people around me. When I lean into my fears, it doesn't even hurt me. It helps. Lean into your fears. Dare them to do their worst and cut them down when they try. If you don't, they'll clone themselves. They'll mushroom till they surround you. Choke the road to the life you want. Every turn you fear is empty air, dressed to look like jagged hell. That's by Richard Bach from Running from Safety. Reset. Recenter. Don't react. Reply. Breathe. Stay present. Don't let the mask put itself on you. That's the thing my experiments are teaching me. To embrace whatever wave comes. The pause of observation. It really helps temper the reaction. I mean, I can't control the waves. I can't control the wind. But I can adjust my sails. And then I can also see the shadow and not run from it. I can open the door slowly. The beginning of all appropriate action, as far as I'm concerned, is awareness. And that requires pause and presence on my part. Thankfully, my experiments are helping me do both of those things. Sure, looking into our shadow self does feel an awful lot like opening a can of worms. But actually, I think it's more like Pandora's box. But only if you know the whole story. Pandora was the very first human woman ever to be created by the gods. The first female on Earth. And she was created as a punishment to all of mankind. See, Zeus wanted to punish humans because Prometheus stole the fire and gave it to us. So he made woman. Anyway, Zeus gives her this box, which was actually an urn, as a wedding gift. The gods told her the box contained special gifts from them, but she was not allowed to open that box. Ever. Does this sound like another epic tale from a book read by millions yet? Yeah, to me too. And just like Eve with the apple, Pandora's curiosity got the better of her. And she did that which she was explicitly told not to do. Geez, women, huh? We're just the cause of all kinds of trouble. Well, Pandora sure did unleash sickness and death and all kinds of other unspecified evils into the world. But that is not where the story ends. You know what else was in that urn? In its shadow space, if you will? The thing that she closed back into the box when she had her knee-jerk reaction of slamming the lid closed as soon as she saw the bat escaping, and she just knew that she was evil and wrong and awful. Well, once the rest had dispersed, the only thing left at the very bottom, hidden in the urn, was hope.
Hi there. This is Kyle, McCall's husband. McCall asked me to contribute to this week's episode, and since we're talking about masks and personas, I was immediately struck with inspiration. If you haven't been listening long, you may have missed some of my other cameos on Unboxing God, like my segment on psychedelic drugs or my exchange with our son Marley about the hero's journey. Additionally, I wrote a piece for episode number 2 about the importance of a name, incorporating the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. All of these disparate segments have a common factor. They all reference pop culture in some way. See, for better or worse, I relate to the world at large through the lens of pop culture. When you provide me with a concept, my brain will automatically connect it to a movie or scene from a TV show or a song that helps me find an entry point to understanding. So when McCall told me this week's theme, I immediately thought of Billy Joel's The Stranger. Specifically, the image of the cover art leaped to my mind. It's a black and white photograph of a shoeless Joel wearing a suit and tie, reclining in bed and gazing at a porcelain mask on the pillow beside him. Hanging on the wall over his left shoulder is a pair of boxing gloves. Featuring all-time bangers like Moving Out, Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, and Only the Good Die Young, The Stranger masquerades as just another studio album when in reality, it's an unofficial greatest hits collection. But it's the title track that I wanted to focus on. The Stranger is a song all about masks, deception, and unexpected revelations. In Jungian psychology, the persona is a mask that we present to the world. It's our best showing, how we would like to be, or at least perceived to be. Chris Rock put it best with regards to dating when he said, "When you meet somebody for the first time, you're not meeting them, you're meeting their representative." But with The Stranger, Billy Joel flips the psychological script. The song opens with the lines, "Well, we all have a face that we hide away forever, and we take them out and show ourselves when everyone has gone. Some are satin, some are steel, some are silk, and some are leather. They're the faces of a stranger, but we love to try them on." Here, Joel is saying the masks that we wear aren't the ones we show to others to make ourselves more desirable. Ironically, they're the ones that actually reveal our deepest secrets. The skeletons that we keep buried so deeply are actually the mask of a stranger, and we rarely allow ourselves to be who we truly are, and only in our most solitary moments. I imagine this is especially true among any population of people who live closeted lives, gay or trans people, undocumented immigrants, any group that has to hide an aspect of their identity for whatever reason. For such individuals, their true self must be so hidden away as to be like the mask of a stranger when they finally allow themselves the luxury of being who they are. He goes on, "Well, we all fall in love, but we disregard the danger. Though we share so many secrets, there are some we never tell. Why were you so surprised that you never saw the stranger? Did you ever let your lover see the stranger in yourself?" Admittedly, this is a pretty cynical view of love and relationships, but this caveat is not unwarranted. Falling in love is emotionally dangerous. Opening yourself to another leaves you vulnerable to hurt, even trauma. So Joel has established his premise in the first verse and urged caution in the second verse. Now in the third verse, he reveals why. "Once I used to believe I was such a great romancer. Then I came home to a woman that I could not recognize. When I pressed her for a reason, she refused to even answer. It was then I felt the stranger kick me right between the eyes." Imagine returning home to a romantic partner who appears unrecognizable. And we know from the premise established in verse 1 that the reason she's unrecognizable is because she's wearing her stranger's mask. In other words, she's revealing her deepest self, and the shock of it is so overwhelming to him, it feels like a kick right between the eyes. But remember, his premise is that we all have a face that we hide away forever. So the stranger that kicks Billy Joel is the same stranger that he also keeps hidden. You get the impression that in that moment, part of the impact was understanding that he'd done the same thing to someone else before. It's easy to come away with a negative view of love, but I think there's another layer as well. If you listen to the whole song, ultimately there's also a message of acceptance. Acceptance of loss, but also accepting the hope of moving on, and the power of accepting the flaws and shortcomings of our friends and loved ones, and even ourselves. Yes, we all have things we struggle with, or we feel the need to keep hidden, but if we can be open to accepting those things in ourselves, and forgiving them in others, we will have a deeper understanding of love and humanity.
So, as I said before, I don't think the shadow self is bad. What I believe is the real danger is right in alignment with Jung. Carl Jung considered as a perennial danger in life that the more consciousness gains in clarity, the more monarchic becomes its content. The king constantly needs the renewal that begins with a descent into his own darkness, his shadow, which the dissolution of the persona sets in motion. Well, when I think I'm clear about anything, if I'm secure and steadfast in my understanding, not just knowledge, that is when I am most at risk. Wasn't it in Don Juan that clarity is one of the four enemies of knowledge? So there's this Swiss Jungian psychologist named Marie-Louise von Franz. She was a scholar known for her psychological interpretations of fairy tales. She considered that the dark side of the self is the most dangerous thing of all, precisely because the self is the greatest power in the psyche. It can cause people to spin megalomaniac or fall into other delusionary fantasies that catch them up, so that the subject thinks with mounting excitement that he's grasped the cosmic riddles. He therefore risks losing all touch with human reality. The shadow personifies everything that the subject refuses to acknowledge about himself. If and when an individual makes an attempt to see his shadow, he becomes aware of, and often ashamed of, those qualities and impulses he denies in himself, but can plainly see in others. Things such as egotism, mental laziness, sloppiness, unreal fantasies, schemes and plots, carelessness and cowardice, love of money and possessions, the painful and lengthy work of self-education. According to Jung, the shadow sometimes overwhelms a person's actions. For example, when the conscious mind is shocked or confused or paralyzed by indecision, as is often my case. A man who is possessed, said Jung, by his shadow, is always standing in his own light and falling into his own traps, living below his own level. So Jung suggests we confront our shadow selves. And he also wrote that the impact of that confrontation with the shadow produces, at first, a dead balance, a standstill that hampers moral decisions and makes convictions ineffective. As he knew from personal experience, in this time of descent, 1, 3, 7 years, more or less, genuine courage and strength are required, with no certainty of emergence. Nevertheless, Jung remained of the opinion that while no one should deny the danger of the descent, every descent is followed by an ascent, and assimilation of, rather than possession by, the shadow becomes at last a real possibility. Here's the struggle: to retain awareness of our shadow but not identify with it entirely. Quote, non-identification demands considerable moral effort which prevents a descent into that darkness. And though the conscious mind is liable to be submerged at any moment in the unconscious, understanding acts like a lifesaver. It integrates the unconscious. This reincorporates the shadow into the personality, producing a stronger, wider consciousness than before. Assimilation of the shadow gives a man body, so to speak, thereby providing a launch pad for further individuation. The integration of the shadow, or the realization of the personal unconsciousness, marks the first stage in the analytic process. Without it, a recognition of anima and animus, which we will also be talking about, is impossible. And conversely, to the degree in which the shadow is recognized and integrated, the problem of the anima, the relationship, is constellated and becomes the center of the individuation quest. Nevertheless, Jungians warn that acknowledgement of the shadow must be a continuous process throughout one's life. And even after the focus of individuation has moved on to the animus anima, our next topic on UBG, the latter stages of shadow integration will continue to take place. The grim process of washing one's dirty linen in private, of accepting one's shadow. Carolyn Kaufman wrote that in spite of its function as the reservoir for human darkness, or perhaps because of this, the shadow is the seat of creativity. Speaking of creativity,
I want to introduce you to a really special friend of mine. Her name is Cass, and she's not only talented, she's super smart and incredibly generous for giving her voice and her music to Unboxing God.
So I wrote this song called Battle Scars when I was like 19 for my theories of personality class. I had always been a fan of Carl Jung and like started learning about him in high school and just digging into the persona and the shadow and the anima and the animus. And I was fascinated by Jung's approach to psychology. And particularly the idea of the persona and the shadow really stood out to me, because at that time I felt like there was a part of myself that I hadn't really connected with yet. I remember a good friend of mine asked me once, "What do you hate?" And I remember so glibly answering, "Nothing. There's nothing that I hate. I was young and innocent." And the concept of hating things, like true hatred and frustration, did not connect with me, because that wasn't what you were supposed to do. That was the persona that I had tried to put forth, you know, that I was all peaceable, all lovely. Nothing was wrong ever. I didn't hate things. I never got angry. But when I looked inside, I found that there was a lot of anger underneath the surface. There was a lot of resentment. There was a lot of hate that I didn't allow other people to see. And I felt unconscious to it. And moments where that would bubble up, I just was like, wait, where did this come from? That's your shadow, Cass. It's what it felt like in that moment. So I wrote this song kind of trying to explore that concept a little bit more. I feel like all the songs I write are trying to psychologize myself. There's a lyric that stands out to me in the bridge. You know, "I am a prisoner stuck behind enemy lines, but tell me just what will I do when the enemy's inside? Tell me what can I do when the enemy's inside?" And I had this idea that I had this fight against myself, a fight against my shadow self. And the older I get, the more I realize that the shadow is not something to fight. That was a misinterpretation of the shadow that I had had. Quite the contrary, it's something to embrace, to recognize, to acknowledge. If I can pause and see, hey, so these feelings are there and they're present, rather than being afraid of being bitten by them, I can manage them, I can acknowledge them, I can hold space for them. Hiding from myself or lying to myself about what I feel and what I think doesn't serve anything. It doesn't serve me moving toward a more integrated self where I know myself and I'm more connected. It leaves me disconnected to myself and leaves parts of myself that could grow or be bettered asleep in my unconscious. And I just think there's too much life to live. There's too much to learn to be asleep to myself, even if those parts are less than desirable. So, yeah.
What will it take? Tell me, what will it take? For all my silly facades to just break. Don't know if I can keep up with this dance. When my sanity's left up to chance. I'm fighting a war with this shell that I'm in. Desperately cling to the hope that I'll win. The longer a stake will tear me up
What a beautiful way to end an episode, huh? To read full show notes and visit external links to outside resources, as well as several episodes' transcripts, including this one, make sure you go to www.unboxinggodpodcast.com. This is McCall signing off until next week, when we explore Jung's idea of the collective unconscious and archetypes. See you then. Bye.